Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gina Barreca's latest book, Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink, is a collection of 28 essays she has edited by a diverse array of women on the topic of women and drinking. The subtopics run the gamut from the question of leisure-class mother-toddler groups that gather in local pubs to the point of view of a woman who grew up sitting on bar stools with her parents. Gina joins us today to talk about that and maybe probably much, much more. Gina Barreca is an English professor at the University of Connecticut and a feminist scholar who has written 8 books. We're going to talk about the latest of which, Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink. Welcome to the show, Gina.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
You know, Maggie Mitchell wrote in her essay, it's near the front of the book, I think. It's called Just a Splash. She wrote that bars offer more literary potential than solitary drinking, but public and private drinking are covered in these essays. I mean, every aspect of it is. How did you figure the breadth of the topics for this collection?
Well, it was interesting because it really did strike me that every representation of a woman drinking in, you know, in literature, in films, in, you know, trashy novels and good novels, it was always misery. And there are great books about women drinking that are enormously sad. I mean, there's, I think it's called Alcohol, A Love Story, or Drinking, A Love Story by Carolyn Knapp. Fabulous. There are tragic stories about women and drinking. We'll start with that. But there's a difference between drinking and being a drunk. Like, there's a difference between sleeping and being a narcoleptic. You know, I mean, so I'm not talking about the desperately horrible stories that can happen for people who have, again, a tragic relationship with alcohol. These are celebratory essays, and it turned out, and poems and short stories, and, you know, it's really a sort of a lovely sort of array. It's like a tasting, you know, it's like a wine tasting, tasting of the different kinds of experiences that women have. And when I started to think about the book, it occurred to me when I was talking to the editor, it's published by the University Press of New England, and she and I decided that this was really one of the most radical topics that we could imagine, because it's really one of the few things that women haven't spoken about. We like to drink. Women like to drink, and it doesn't mean we're luscious, and it doesn't mean we're evil, and it doesn't mean that we're not all for mothers against drunk driving, and it's not, you know, all of that. But we all felt a need to explain that every time a woman, that's why a lot of these essays, like Maggie Mitchell's Just a Splash, that if you offer a woman a drink, she says, oh, just a little one. You know, I'll just have a bit. Oh, this is my first one this week. This is my first one, you know, today. This is my first. I mean, it's this constant apology. And I thought, I never heard a man do that. You offer a guy a drink, and he goes, yeah, I'll make mine a double. You know, I mean, let's get with it. And so I thought, what is this? Still in a culture where, you know, many women have learned to ask for what we want and what gives us pleasure and the rest, that we're still offering apologies for this one seemingly, you know, sort of puritanical sort of impulse that we still have, where we're seemingly always apologetic for this, that it's very rare that, you know, two women sit down at a bar and say, no, just bring us a bottle because we're going to be here, you know? And the song that you started with at the top of the show.
Four Drunken Maidens.
Exactly. This is really, you know,
yo, ho, ho.
Yeah, exactly. It's always followed by the, you know, it's great because we think of the images that we have of women drinking are really like Hogarth's Gin Lane, that famous print, right, of the woman who's got a bottle in her hand and she's nursing the baby, but the baby's about to fall out of her arms and clearly, you know, die in some horrible thing. And I'm thinking, this is not it. You know, women sitting at a bar are still, it's such a strange sort of image in our society. You see it. But it's still like I was, you know, I'm there. I'm in my 50s. I'm not exactly, you know, jailbait. I'm sitting there with another, you know, woman, and actually who's you know, works for the government. I mean, she's actually very the powerful, authoritative position. I'm having a drink, and a man comes up and says, and I quote, "Are you girls alone?" You know, and first of all, the girls thing, are you girls alone? And he was clearly trying to be flirtatious. And he wasn't evil, but it was, are you girls alone? And to which I realized the only answer was, no, actually, we're together. You're alone. You know, I mean, it's still the idea that even two women sitting at a bar must be in need of male chaperonage, if not company. And so I asked the smartest woman that I know from age 21 to age, I think, 79 when she wrote the essay, Faye Weldon.
Yeah.
And so we cover the gamut, and actually the 21-year-old, her essay got excerpted by Elle magazine.
Which one? Which one's that?
It's by Carrie Brown.
Okay.
And it's called, I think it's One for the Boys. And it's about how not to rape while drunk. And because Carrie, as a young woman, had grown up, a word for the boys, Carrie Brown, how to drink but not rape. And because she'd grown up, she was one of my students at the University of Connecticut, where I teach. And she'd written this essay for my non-fiction writing course. And because she grew up listening to all of this advice now given to young women, quite right, that the 10 things you have to do to avoid being assaulted. You know, when you go out, you have to go with friends. You know, maybe you could take a rape whistle with you. You should make sure that nobody gets near your drink. You should make sure that you always walk in well-lit places. And she said, okay, what about if we instead tell women how not to get raped? How about if we tell boys how not to rape?
Since really, date rape or acquaintance rape is the most common.
Right. And just like, so the boys should only drink in a group because if you're in a group, you're less likely to rape. You know, carry a rape whistle. When you're feeling an urge to assault a friend, you know, blow the whistle and have your friends come and rescue you from it. It's hysterically funny. And it's one of the few things, I mean, you know, for years, right, since Ms. Magazine, I think, you know, first answers, can there be anything funny about rape? This is the funny because it's for men. Men should only walk in well-lit areas, she says. You know, it's sometimes impossible, you know, for you not to walk, but this way, if you walk in a well-lit area, you're visible to others who are in close proximity, and they can therefore be wary of you. This will reduce your desire to attack, and you'll be more aware of your potential witnesses to your crime. You know, I mean, so it's like it takes all these 10 points and reverses them. Mm-hmm. And you just hear when everything that women are told, if you just turn it around, it was like, I think it was Elaine Boozler who, you know, used to start her act, a stand-up comic, great stand-up comic, who got up and said, you know, I'm 30 years old and I don't have any kids. Well, at least none that I know of. All you have to do is turn it around. And you don't even need a punchline. You just have to say it. I mean, there's no need for a bada boom, bada bing. You just have to say it. So so the essays go from very funny to actually very sentimental. Maggie Mitchell's essay that you mentioned earlier is a beautiful one. And it's about her mother who died a few years ago, but calling everybody she loved, her family, mostly to her deathbed. And, you know, and making sure that, you know, Margaret, as I know her, went out and, you know, bought wine and scotch for everybody, and that they really sat around with her mom, and she realized that her mother was throwing one last great booze up for everybody. You know, she died the next day. And, I mean, her mother was dying of emphysema. I mean, she wasn't drinking. Mm-hmm. But around her, everybody was, and that it was a real – her mother liked parties, and it was her mother – you know, Maggie grew up sort of, you know, going to pubs with her parents and sitting there and being very happy, as she said, in the company of adults. I mean, it was very much the sort of the pub atmosphere as opposed to the bars where children aren't welcome. And, in fact, a lot of the pieces in the book are about mothers. And either women remembering, you know, when they first had a first glass of wine with their mother, or mothers now trying to decide whether, you know, they can bring their kids. There's a wonderful one called the Park Slope Stroller.
Right. That's the I mentioned that in the introduction.
The
leisure class mother toddler group.
Right. And it was
very interesting question.
A fascinating question, because these women would go to this big sort of open space bar, sort of neighborhood bar, In the middle of the afternoon, when it was the time when the place was not busy, a lot of them were writers. A lot of them, you know, had very successful writers in their, you know, in their own right and on their own time. And they would go meet. They would bring their kids. The kids would sort of, you know, color or sit. I mean, it wasn't like they were wreaking havoc. The mothers would have a glass of wine or a martini or whatever they would do. They would stay there. They'd bring business to the place. But then people were just offended. You know, when the patrons would start to come in, let's say at 4 o'clock, they would be offended. They would be that there would be strollers in the pub. They would be, how dare you? This is not a place to bring children. They would either be officious and judgmental, or they would just say, how dare these women, you know, sort of occupy a space that should just be, you know, adults. We want to talk about adults. But these are women off there. It's not like the children are clinging to the legs of strangers or asking them to buy them a Dubonnet on the rocks. I mean, this is, you know.
Like mommy does.
Right, exactly. Right. So it's just a fascinating exploration of this without a sort of self-excoriation, you know, and they're lively there. Catherine Conant, who's a professional storyteller, writes a wonderful piece about growing up in an Italian family where you start having wine at a meal at the early possible age. You have, you know, mm-hmm. you'll have little drops
right.
of wine in your water from when you're a kid so that you learn how to have a little wine, and then it just darkens as you get older.
She brings up an interesting idea that, we teach people how to drive cars, but we don't teach people how to drink.
Right.
And then when they turn 21, they're magically supposed to know how to do both at the same time.
Right, right. That's, yes. I mean, and it's perfect, and it also illustrates something about the American culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, where European kids don't binge drink like Americans do. It's one of the things that when my students go on study abroad programs, they're always so interested when they come back. They go to Ireland or they go to France or they go to Italy, and that they always say that the kids there don't drink like American students do. You know, they don't go out to get smashed. They'll go to a bar or a pub or to a disco or, you know, whatever. But it's not the same allure.
It's not the forbidden fruit.
Exactly, exactly. And God knows it's a low-hanging forbidden fruit.
Right. I said 21 just to be conversational,
right.
but really
right.
it's, you know, they start drinking much younger than typically. We have to take a quick break, Gina.
Okay.
I want to invite our listeners, though, if you want to speak with Gina Baraka, humorous speaker and author of her newest book, Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink or Not. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also, as usual, email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. Behind the news, there are real people with something to say. We bring them to you. Roundtable conversations with coal miners, the out-of-work soldiers, their families, and more. Honest conversations about the issues with the people who live their reality. It's fresh perspective you won't hear anywhere else. Join us for the next On Point.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on today's show. Is American decline exaggerated? It's a hot topic again. On Point, here's the debate. That discussion begins this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 32 degrees with some clouds in downtown Columbus. Partly sunny skies today and a high of 48. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 38 degrees. And again, unseasonably warm on Tuesday, mostly sunny and a high of 57. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gina Baraka, humorist, speaker, and author of her newest book we're talking about today, Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink or Not. If you have a question or comment for Gina Baraka, a drinking story of your own, Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The whole thing kicks off. Well, of course, you're forward, but Kristen Dombeck writes a piece called Speakeasy and makes the point at the outset that the history of the emancipation of women in the United States is the history of a war on whiskey, ironically, that it empowered women, even as women were seen as restricting the women who fought for the prohibition, seen as restricting rights, they actually expanded the rights of women. I thought that was interesting, particularly in light of, you know, the latest Ken Burns documentary, Prohibition.
Right. It's absolutely fascinating because you had Carrie Nation, who is the woman with the hatchet that we always, you know, sort of see her. She felt that she was compelled, you know, sort of by God to get out there and chop down. I mean, she would go in there with a violence that was sort of unseen in terms of, you know, feminine behavior and go into bars and wreck them. She felt that she would a hatchetation would come upon her. But what Kristen Dombeck argues, and again, it's such a fascinating essay, is about the idea that what there had always been separate places for men to drink from women, that they could not drink together. And that it was, in fact, only when working women, when factories opened and in urban areas where you know, there was a little separate entrance for women to go and drink, and usually they would be offered drink by the proverbial free lunch. There would be hot food provided for factory workers who actually got 20 minutes to eat. So they would go and have a beer and have lunch and go back to the factory. But the women had to drink separately. And it was only during Prohibition, which prohibited anybody from drinking, that the speakeasies opened, and the women would then go with the men to the speakeasies. And so there was this blending of male-female company, and men and women learned that it was fun to drink together. And, of course, that was also during the age of, you know, the flapper and Prohibition, actually, as we know, not only from watching Ken Burns, but from watching, let's say, Boardwalk Empire, mm-hmm. that it was, you know, a transitional moment between, you know, leaving the old ways of a sort of a regulated society to the sort of the advent of modernism, where women were then also cutting their hair. They were beginning to emphasize education, no longer a sort of economic reliance on men. They were going to work in new numbers. They were being educated in new numbers. And that the speakeasies, in being driven underground, actually allowed women to sort of come out and participate in another way. And since it was illegal for everybody, then women could sort of be part of that, you know, underworld and then emerge out of it sort of fully-fledged members. And Kristen Dombeck's thing is also, you know, interesting that she chooses speakeasy. The women writing in this book are so smart. And, you know, one of the nice things, I got to say, I'm very proud of the fact that all the profits from this book go to funds that my husband and I set up at a hospital in Connecticut called Gina's Friends, which supports programs for women who do not have the money to get the sort of diagnostic tests and cannot afford the sort of healthcare, women who have sort of fallen through the safety net in a way. And so all the money from the book goes to help women, women's healthcare. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know,
absolutely,
that people didn't think that we were actually making a profit out of this. And, the press was all behind that. They're going to recoup costs. And so she was also talking about, because all the essays are also personal, mm-hmm. it's not just a historic essay that Kristen is doing, that it's about her moving to New York and being terribly shy and wanting to write, but then being accepted in these sort of local pubs, these local bars in New York, where she would sit next to sort of 8-year-old Ukrainian men in the East Village who would talk, and that she learned to come out of herself. So Speakeasy is also about her learning to come out of her shyness, and not really through the alcohol itself, but through the atmosphere, the welcoming atmosphere of a bar, of a neighborhood place. And so the speakeasy works in a double way. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say Liz Donnelly raised the same sort of issue with her mother.
Right. Liza Donnelly.
Liza Donnelly.
Yeah, Liza Donnelly, who is the brilliant New Yorker cartoonist. People can go onto Liza Donnelly's website, for example, and you will see her. She's a staff cartoonist for The New Yorker. And somebody also very interested, she and I met over our interest in women's humor. She's edited a number of big, gorgeous books, I think published by Broadway Books, of called Funny Women, which was a history of women cartoonists from The New Yorker. And you talk about a fabulous look at American life through the eyes of very few women cartoonists have ever made it, and looking at the women who have made it into the pages of The New Yorker, from the early 1900s through today. And then she, she's done other ones of, on love and sex, which she's edited with her husband, Michael Maslin, who's also a New Yorker cartoonist. So she did the cover, which is this, it's a brilliant cover.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous. And that's why Make Mine a Double is really like, I also wanted to make it a book that women would get for each other on their birthdays, on their retirements, on 21st birthdays, but on, bridal showers, on divorces.
Along with a really nice set of wine glasses.
With wine set or a
martini,
bottle of bubbly.
Right.
Exactly. That this would be perfect. And, but Liza, yes, talking about she wanted to make sure that she didn't become her mother. A lot of the essays, and that's why the subtitle is Why Women Like Us Like to Drink or Not, because several of the essays are about not drinking. Susan Campbell, for example, who is a prize-winning journalist for the Hartford Courant, writes about growing up in the South and always being too afraid to drink. She said she knew if she had her first beer, she would immediately get pregnant, year after year with illegitimate children, which they would call wood cults. So she learned to be bad in other ways. But it's all about her never liking alcohol and never really being compelled to drink. But Liza's a very touching essay,
yes.
Liza Donnelly.
It was very sad, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely, about really not wanting to become her mother, not, sort of avoiding the seduction of alcohol. But again, Catherine Conant, that we talked about before, mm-hmm. her essay is about, having those sips of wine to say salut at a dinner, but being always really happy never to have been in a position where she's had so much to drink somebody could take a picture of her lying down on a sofa with her mouth open, after a long party. And there are, it's really interesting. Of women telling the truth. Faye Weldon, who is one of my favorite authors that people might know as the author of Life and Loves of a She-Devil, or she was,
she's written so many
mm-hmm. fabulous novels. And now, because of the fame of Downton Abbey, Faye was the original writer on Upstairs, Downstairs.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she wrote the opening episode. She created the characters in Upstairs, Downstairs.
Okay.
And so I think that Downton Abbey is really just another version of Upstairs, Downstairs. Mm-hmm. I always feel like it should be, Faye should be credited. So she has her essay, Hilarity and Mirth. She's the most senior writer in our book. And her essay begins, "Sometimes I marvel at how rich I would be if only I hadn't listened to my psychoanalyst." And so she's, and the psychoanalyst is sort of explaining how she should live it within her income and all the rest of it. But then is also saying that she needs to indulge herself. And that's it. Women, we go back and forth between the idea of either I'm going to indulge myself and be bad, or I'm going to withhold every pleasure for myself and be good. And obviously human beings can't live that way, that it's not either this, I can give myself no pleasure and be good. That's not what goodness is, that's abstinence. And that doesn't lead to happiness. Unless you're abstaining from things you don't like or that can damage you.
Mm-hmm. Rita Cerasi.
She
likes to drink alone. It's very interesting commentary. Of course, when she describes her behavior during trips to Vegas, I kind of get the idea why she drinks alone. It's like a poison to her. I'm serious. It's shocking.
Oh, listen to you now. Shocking. Well, that's it.
Wow.
Somebody's going to be shocked at everything. No, Rita Cerasi, very funny writer, professor mm-hmm. in Florida, who wrote Pink Slip and, Were You Always Italian? And it's a very funny, again, very self-revelatory. People really, the writers for this book, for Make Mine a Double, really really pop the cork, you know? They really let go. And I think that that's one of the reasons that, you know, you could put the book up and down. I always like to write books. I mean, the book I did, you know, this one I edited, the book I wrote before this that you and I spoke about was called It's Not That I'm Bitter.
Right.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Visible Panty Lines and Conquer the World. And because of the way women live our lives, I mean, we're always reading in bits and pieces. It's very, we don't sit down and, you know, with the Brothers Karamazov, however brilliant it is, and read the whole thing straight through. We read in 20-minute shots, you know, while we're waiting for somebody, while we're, you know, we have 50 minutes before we go to bed, or 50 minutes when we're sitting with a cup of coffee in the morning. You know, our lives are often so fragmented. And so the book is fun. Mm-hmm. You could read them straight through, but it's also fun to sort of dip in and out and to see what people are saying. And some of them, I mean, you've got...
went to Nicole Hollander first.
Oh, Nicole. She,
you know, you can look in the table of contents,
yeah.
And that's the one I went to first.
Now,
I loved it.
Nicole Hollander is our goddess because she writes the Sylvia cartoons,
right?
And she's somebody else whose website is brilliant. You can go and get Sylvia's Bad Girl Chats every day, which I love. and Nicole Hollander has been doing this stuff now, you know, political, cultural commentary from the mouth of Sylvia for more than 25 years. And she's one of the smartest women that I know, and also really the most self-effacing. She's really, and I said, Nicole, you must have a story. She said, I don't really drink. I said, tell me a story. So she tells a story about her sister. I don't know if she's given.
We all got a story about our sister
exactly.
Who drank.
I don't know if she's given a copy of the book to her sister. I thought it was really very funny. So Nicole is always going to make it. You know, the women who do comedy for a living, like Nicole Hollander or Wendy Liebman, who's a stand-up comic, and she has her essay, which I sort of made into a poem, because it's almost a series of one-liners. And she is, again, she said, I don't, she's one of the, she and I met actually on a panel, Wendy Liebman and I met on a panel about women's humor at Harvard, which is not where, you know, usually meet stand-up comics, you know, in a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning. But Wendy Liebman, you know, oh, Harvard, oh, yes, this is where we all, where all stand-up comics meet. And so my favorite line, it may be one of my favorite lines from the book, I mean, I hesitate to choose one, but Wendy says, scientists discovered the gene for alcoholism. It was the one wearing a lampshade. And I want that on a T-shirt. You know what I mean? I really think that that's been, you know, I think, and she says, I've been drunk 4 times. I don't mean karaoke drunk, where you drink enough to sing MacArthur Park in a lounge in Vegas at the top of your lungs off key with your skirt hyped up. I've done that, you know. You know, but again, she's a stand-up comic. She's just really fabulous, but it's dangerous. You know, it's dangerous for women to talk about this stuff because somebody's going to say, how dare you? How could you put this down? Like, didn't I? And I think that the only answer to this is that this is about having fun. This is really about having fun. And it's not about putting yourself or others in danger. And so that the stories that people are telling are about the, you know, the idea of Sophia Romero's The Sun Over the Yardarm is about being a Filipino woman who marries a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn and whose new Jewish mother-in-law is explaining to her how to drink, even though the Jewish mother-in-law doesn't drink, but is explaining to her the American expressions, like there's always, you know, the sun is always down over the yard on somewhere, which for years Sophia could not figure out what on earth that meant until someone explained the nautical version of this, because the mother-in-law didn't know what it meant. She just knew that that's like what Americans said when they were looking for a reason to drink. You know? So you got the various cultural things. Sarah Rasher does the Foreign Girls Tour of Japanese Nightlife, where she's going. She's a lesbian writer, and she's going to these bars where, you know, Japanese men are trying to pick her up until she tries to explain to them, you know, what her deal is. And then she is going, you know, it's really an excursion through the karaoke bars of Tokyo from her perspective as somebody who was teaching English in Japan for a couple of years. And it's a riot. I mean, it's just silly and funny and well written, and that you're looking, most of them are sort of, you know, one-off stories. They're not stories of a lifetime of drinking. They're stories about, this is what happened to me. It wouldn't have happened without alcohol. And so this is what, you know, the player is in this particular
And incident. Others are the thread.
Yes.
Of alcohol.
Right.
Through their lives.
Right, exactly. You have that brilliant one that's the absinthe to Zima. That's the,
yes,
A to Z version. Again, beautifully, beautifully written. And where she starts with being a girl, a young girl in Paris, and it's Nicole Callender, and absinthe, you are 20. Your hair is dirty, but your eyes are bright. You're studying abroad, have already perfected ordering your pint of cider. But then you read that quote by Oscar Wilde, the one about how drinking absinthe gives him the particular feeling of having two lips on his leg. So you slimp from bar to bar in Prague, whispering, absinthe, please. And then it goes through. It's really an A to Z. But right. Then she imagines she's the mother of two kids, and she imagines Zima, you know, and that she imagines her daughter asking her, you know, when she's a teenager, what about this, mom? And then imagining telling her daughter, no, this is not how you drink. You know, this will be, you know, if she imagines that 10 years down the road, I think her daughter's, you know, 8 now, 10 years down the road, you know, giving her daughter a sip of wine and saying, don't drink this. This is the lovely part of this. Don't just drink to drink, drink to enjoy, drink to assess, drink to be convivial, to be part of a community. And it's really, it's again, almost like a poem. It's really absolutely lovely.
You, I, of course, the second thing I looked for was, what did Gina write? And it's one page. It's a poem.
Yes, it is.
Please,
yes, it is.
Read that for us.
Yes,
now.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I started, you know, my secret beginning of a writing life, as so often happens with writers, was with poetry. But and it's been interesting over the years to sort of see these, to see the poems sort of come back. One of them has been anthologized. It's called Nighttime Fires in a number of anthologies, including my husband's. And so I decided, oh, if everybody else is going to do what's dangerous for them, I'll do the thing that's most scary for me, and I'll put in one of my poems. So this one is called Permission Slips. Permission slipped me a drink almost imperceptibly across the bar's top. I sip and won't stop until I slip, lose my step, misspeak, mutter, then utterly permit no more to pass my lips. I'll slip out unnoticed, no note, not loud, yet aloud, down the hall, out the door, slip away, leaving laughter behind me, on a sure footing, no heel broken, no slip showing, as per my mission.
Is that, did you say that's recently written, or?
Oh, yes, I just wrote this one for the book. And because I was thinking permission slips, you know, when we're always looking.
It's such an internal conversation going on there. It's just.
Right, and the idea that we're always at what we're looking, I think, again, women and men certainly, but a lot of women looking for permission slips in life. Do I have a right to do this? You know, can I ask somebody, it's like, is it okay if I do this? Is it, and, you know, looking for somebody to give us a note that lets us know we're all right and that we're not alone. And that's what, you know, most of the books that I've either edited or written are trying to explore women's lives honestly, at which, again, usually end up being funny because real life is funny. I mean, my emphasis on humor is always that, you know, women don't tell jokes, women tell stories. And that's because once women start telling the truth about our lives, we don't need to make up a joke. When we start telling the truth about our lives, it's funny. And so I thought about the idea of a permission slip, but then I thought, What about, you know, slipping somebody something? The idea of slipping goes so many ways. You can slip as in, like, slipping as in a misstep, but also a slip, like a slip a woman wears. Slip is a word that comes up in a woman's life a lot. And so I thought, oh, let me play with the idea of slips through this, and that it doesn't have to be a mistake. It could actually be permission. And that you can do this, as I tried to get to at the end, that you can leave with the laughter behind you before you misstep, that it can be something that you do before it leads. You can stop before it leads to something that is regrettable, you know, that you leave with the winces, you know, as we call them, where you're going, oh, did I say that? You know, that it doesn't have to be that. It can be very much something else where you really that sense of again, putting your arms around each other's shoulders, you know, like the permission that we've given for guys to do for so long, and to see it as an act of, again, conviviality, of literally living life together, convivial.
My guest is Gina Barreca, humorist, speaker, teacher, and author of her latest, she edited, Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink or Not, edited by Gina Barreca. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's Fresh Air, musician, composer, actor, Stu, otherwise known as Mark Stewart. He is a member of two bands, and he's also known for having written the popular song Gary Come Home for SpongeBob SquarePants. That is on Fresh Air at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Join Kappa, WOSU, and Capital Crossroads SID for a special screening of Columbus Neighborhoods, Franklinton Downtown, at the Ohio Theater on Tuesday, February 14th. The program begins with the Ohio Mighty Morgan Organ Pre-Show at 11:30 a.m. Pre-sale tickets, including a fresh box lunch, and the chance to win tickets to the Broadway series production of Memphis. For tickets to a screening, call Kappa at 614-469-0939 or visit columbusneighborhoods.org. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 49 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 38. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Gina Barreca, humorist, speaker, women's author. We are talking about a book, her newest book she just edited. It's called Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us Like to Drink. If you have a question or comment for Gina, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Love to hear your drinking story. Again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Nicole Hollander's essay, we brought it up earlier, it read just like I would have imagined, and she writes about how drink saved her sibling relationship, and a lot of the stories or a lot of the comments in here have to do with family.
Absolutely. They really do. They are about, again, it's either their moms, one certainly... her father, there's really interesting ones, or about the formation of other kinds of family. Greta Scheibel has one of the most interesting ones, I think, too, which is about when she was working in the Peace Corps, and where the men would get together and drink, and with Sunday at the Kiblabu, which is drinking club in Swahili. I think it's the only time anybody uses Swahili in the book. And that the men were allowed to get together and drink. But since she was there, she lived in this village for over 3 years. And she became sort of an authority and a teacher, and, you know, they respected her. So that they let her drink with the men. And but they were saying, you know, this is big stuff. And Greta had you know, was always wanted to take on a challenge. I mean, after all, she's living, you know, in a village in Tanzania. And so she goes in there and she starts to drink it. It's this very sweet stuff that they're drinking. And the women are standing around the edge watching her drink and, like, to look after her, you know, because she's still, after all, this, you know, girl in her 20s. And the men, it's almost like a fraternity party, but in another land, and the men are sort of urging her to drink and chanting, and it's her sort of having to prove her worth, you know, and she manages to do it, and she manages to, you know, drink as much as whatever, you know, the guy who's head of the village drinks, and then, you know, the women take her out and, like, put her to bed, you know, they manage to do this, but, you know, it was sort of a proving ground, you know, for her, and it was, It's just, again, it's a marvelous story. It's the other version of the sort of, you know, the woman going to the other place that the National Geographic is not going to actually, you know, going to reveal. But maybe one of the ones that's most impressive about actual family, traditional family, mm-hmm. is Sarah Deming's called Against Mixology.
Yeah.
Where she's going in to a bar with her dad.
Yeah.
And she's living in a, you know, hip neighborhood in New York. And her father is from Oklahoma. And she goes in. And the father wants to get a drink that has amaretto in it. Some kind of...
Amaretto sour.
Amaretto sour.
I remember
right.
It.
Very good. Right. Amaretto sour. And the... You know, he thinks of the guy behind the bar as a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows from this hip New York neighborhood that it's a mixologist. And so the mixologist doesn't like to use amaretto, you know, in his concoctions. And the father is getting sort of increasingly frustrated by this. And it's this sort of old New York versus new New York, you know, version of what a bar is supposed to drink, you know. What a customer is supposed to drink, that the bartender now has, you know, all the rights to tell you what you're supposed to be having, and that the customer is not always right, but that it's sort of it's a gulf between her and her father that's sort of sad, actually, you know. I mean, it's funny, but it's an interesting sort of divide.
Mm-hmm.
Between, you know, a moment in her life.
You know,
her and her father.
I put myself through college partly as a bartender, and it took me years to realize that a lot of the people coming in every single day, 5 days a week,
yeah.
weren't there because they wanted to talk politics with me. So
right.
let's hear from hear from Harrison in Columbus, and then we'll get to Lisa. Harrison, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Recent listener, loving it, and so I'm glad to be able to call in. I missed bits of the conversation with work, so I apologize if I get off subject a little bit. But, you know, it's funny. I hear about the stories of the women growing up and their thoughts and drinking and how they were perceived. My mother was a very forefront, independent person. And whenever she was drinking something, and she had three boys, mm-hmm. before she was, you know, like, if we would see her drinking, we would ask her, what is that? And she would say it was wine or maybe a beer or something. And plus, she was an entertainer, so she was around alcohol a lot. She would let us sip it. I don't ever remember not having at least accessibility to alcohol in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able, since we tasted it and so forth, that we didn't go on these binges. Oh, my gosh, I'm 16. Let's go to a senior party and get drunk because we can.
Right.
Type thing. But what was very interesting is she married a man who had two daughters. When they got older, the rules were different for them in his eyes. You know, they would come up and ask, you know, what are you drinking? You know, can we have a sip? And my stepfather would say no. But my mother would be like, why? I don't understand the difference between, you know, your stepsons and your daughters. You know, and we were raised step and half. We were raised brothers and sisters. My mom didn't believe in that step or whatever. And we were all young when they married. So, but my mom just never, and she never could get that answer. Like, why is it okay for our boys to have sips and question alcohol or any other type of drug for that matter? But yet it was totally different set of rules for the girls.
And did the girl, can I ask, did the girls, did your sisters grow up drinking differently from the way you did?
Yes, they did, actually.
They did.
Yeah. They were the ones who, hey, so-and-so's having a party, and they would lie, you know. I'm going to go spend the night at Jennifer's house, but they were actually at a party at Susie's house.
Yeah.
You know, because they didn't have that
experience.
They did
experience. That too.
You know, yeah. You know. I mean, so, you know, they didn't have that experience like, oh, it's okay. It's just a beer. I don't get the big deal.
Right.
You
and know. That's the whole thing. It's the big deal part of it. And that, that's what a lot of the stories are about. It's for women also learning that it's not a big deal. But it's not a big deal, but it can be fun, but it can't be. It can't be the thing, like any kind of way that, especially what you're saying, Harrison, is such a perfect illustration that it's somehow okay for the boys, but for the girls, it'll somehow ruin you. That was said about sex and money for women.
Right, and that's just,
I hope, over that.
You know, and that flabbergasted my mom because she was like, I don't understand. You know, she remembers what it was like being a teenager and everything that, you know, her first sips of coming from the hollows of West Virginia was moonshine. So, you know, much different than what we have to drink today.
But, and everything was easier after that, too.
Yeah. Wasn't it, though? She sure could really sing after that.
Harrison, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening. You too. Lisa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Oh, thank you. Gina, if you ever run out of material in New England, I would love to see you in Texas for a while watching the centuries-old attitude towards women there.
Oh, really?
I think you could have a book in roughly 4.5 days.
Lisa, that's interesting. There is a different culture. What's that about?
Well, it didn't have to do with my
I know, but I,
story,
you brought it up, so now I'm curious.
I'll tell you a story. I was coming home from a business trip, driving home from the airport, and along all Texas freeways are these what they call service roads where the businesses are. It's kind of bizarre, but you get used to it. And I needed some tennis balls, so I stopped in whatever the drugstore along the way was, famous chain, and I picked up a 3-pack can of tennis balls, and the clerk looked at me and said, oh, does your boyfriend play tennis?
Oh!
And I looked in shock, not being originally from Texas, and said, well, yeah, he's playing with me tomorrow morning, which is why I'm buying these tennis balls. I thought I'd be polite and bring, you know, my own can of balls. But, and I could tell you, as I said, a story a day along those lines.
Wow.
But my drinking story is a little bit of a cautionary tale. I used to be just a slight, relaxed drinker, and I found living in Texas a little bit of that was needed, like on a daily basis. And one night, I was about to go to the Safeway to pick up some food for dinner. It's wise to shop daily in Texas so that the bugs don't get your food before you do. So I was about to go to the Safeway, and I had, and I'm saying this quite literally, like 1.5 ounces of wine,
mm-hmm.
and then headed out in my car to drive. I'll age myself here. I used to be a Ms. Pac-Man fan, and I always used to get about 10,000 points maybe when whipping through a Ms. Pac-Man.
Nice.
After 1.5 ounces, I went into the Safeway, played their Ms. Pac-Man game, and got 3,000 points. Now, that's only one test, but it really changed my attitude towards saying, wow, drinking and driving doesn't necessarily mean having had 7 beers and driving.
Right.
And
that's interesting, but that's a really wonderful story, actually. That would be a lovely essay. If I do a second version of this book, we do another edition.
I'll go right to you.
Yeah, that's a really good one. That's really a good story. That's a good illustration of just the fact that every time that you think, and that's why you can't, you know, you just can't. If that's why, actually, we've done such a good job with this next generation of you know, 20 years younger than me, for example, where the designated drivers that I see, I they take it so seriously. My students will come in and, you know, I've got the kids who work in my office, whatever, and they're like, you're the DD tonight, and they don't drink at all. And they have a big circle, and so they really, but they absolutely, I said, do you just drink less? They said, oh, no, you can't drink. If you're the designated driver, you can't drink at all that night. And it's like something we did with all those ads and the saturation with that. They know better than we did, and I'm grateful for that. We did that well as a culture.
I was thinking about that movie, Say Anything, the John Cusack character where he's the master of the keys.
Yeah.
And it's that same idea, and I thought, I remember watching that movie for the first time thinking, what are they doing?
Yeah.
They're giving him his keys willingly.
No, it's really, I mean, but that's the whole thing. And that's where, again, it's taking it out of the closet, like everything else. Mm-hmm. It's taking it out of the closet. And if it is just sort of part of life and the fun part of life, and so that even, you know, you get the fun, I won't talk about it because it's such a funny essay, but Amy Lynch's essay, there's one young woman who talks about getting drunk once and why she'll never do it again. And it's hysterical. And it's very brief. And it's a really, it's almost like a, you know, like a silent movie short because you have to watch it to get it. So it's really, it's a really fun one. So that one. But then you've got Karen Renner's very funny. The cocktail is fashion accessory, which is her personal history. It's like
the Mom's Club.
Right, the Mom's Club. That's Laura Rossi about, again, when she was terrified after going from being this fabulous, you know, publicist in New York and then being a suburban mom and getting involved in these, like being asked to go to a purse party or a knitting party and then realizing that they were just covers for, like, you know, they would, you know, the husbands would drop these women off. And, in fact, they were gourmet meals with fabulous wine tastings. Tonight we're doing Pinot Noirs or tonight we're doing Chateau Neuf de Pops, you know, it's a blind tasting so that you've got them all in paper bags and then you rate them individually. And, you know, really not this terrible, please don't eat the daisies version of the world that she was terrified that at 28 she was going to be getting into. So it's, again, real women, real stories, and just another way for all of us to get together and tell the truth about our lives. And like I said, a lot of it, as the truth always is, it breaks your heart and it makes you laugh out loud. So it doesn't sort of get better than when we get together and really talk about what our lives are like.
And something that I liked about the book is it's done, and there's a lot of authors here. There's a lot of voices. It's not how do you edit something like this?
Well, it was hard. There were some people who a lot of them were invited. You know, I mean, I asked people I knew, Amy Bloom, of course, another prominent author, and you know, and there were some people who I did ask who just either they couldn't, they thought they could, or the tone just really wasn't right, that they ended up writing about something that was so tragic, or they discovered something about themselves while they were doing it. I think other people started out writing for the book that then they ended up publishing in, you know, very good literary journals. You know, it ended up in the Kenyon Review or something that started out as a piece for this book, but then it became like the start of their next novel. So it was really, but you know, I mean, it was very, almost nobody said they couldn't do it. Because
everyone's
those who did not
story.
Drink, everybody had a story. Right. So Nicole tells the one about her sister, Susan Campbell tells the one about being a bad girl. Other ways, Catherine Conner talks about just getting the sips of wine in the water. You know, everybody had something to say. And so it's an honor, again, to be in the company of such a mixed group. Dawn Lundy Martin, you know, an African-American woman writer who is a great poet who teaches in Pittsburgh, writes about how the only hands you ever saw holding a martini in an American movie were black hands, were white hands. So she does a brilliant essay on that.
Gina Barreca, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I hope we'll talk again soon.
I hope so, too. Gina Barreca, women's author, humorist, speaker, and editor of Make Mine a Double, Why Women Like Us, Like to Drink, or Not. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.